As you shared that about your sister, I am reminded of Walt Dues, who worshiped with us for a number of years until they moved to Arizona, who was personally acquainted with Robert Gates, who was, correct me, Secretary of Defense, and who had a personal calling to pray for Robert Gates in that. And I think it's interesting, there's not a group of pacifist Quakers anywhere that did more prayer for Robert Gates. And that we really own that, that we do not abandon our call to pacifists, and yet we surround Jasmine in prayer and in holding, and that God will be with her and give her what she needs, and that God's love will pursue her in this place, and it will be a transformative and life-giving experience for her. So I love that we can be fully Quaker and fully pacifist and yet shower someone like Jasmine with God's love and blessing. So we just trust that God will do a miracle in her life. In John 11, we read the story of Lazarus, who died to the dismay of his sisters, Mary and Martha. However, Jesus finally arrived and raised Lazarus from the dead. Because of that, many, many people followed Jesus. But that was troublesome to the Pharisees, who were increasingly troubled by Jesus and his popularity and all of the people that were choosing to follow him. The chief priests and Pharisees began to openly plot Jesus' death. John 12 opens with a follow-up to this story about Lazarus and a meal of gratitude. And I'm going to read the first 8 verses of John 12. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, the home of Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. There they gave a dinner for him. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those at the table with him. Mary took a pound of costly perfume made of pure nard, anointed Jesus' feet, and wiped them with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples, the one who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. He kept the common purse and used to steal what was put into it. Jesus said, "Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you don't always have me." We first encounter Mary and Martha in Luke chapter 10, where Jesus visits their home. Martha is the doer. She prepares the meal and creates a hospitable welcome into their home as Jesus comes to visit. Mary, on the other hand, is the one who simply sits at Jesus' feet and listens to his teaching. They have a little spat as Martha is frustrated that Mary left her in the kitchen to do all the work and was not being helpful. But Jesus actually sides with Mary and said that she has chosen the better part. Here we find them giving a dinner in Jesus' honor as they express gratitude for their brother's life. Real gratitude. Their brother that was dead is now living. And this gratitude of wanting to serve a meal that says thank you, a meal in honor of Jesus and of Lazarus, and the friendship that they share, the love between them. The familiar patterns hold here as well. Martha is the doer, and she serves the meal and does the work, while Mary does the frivolous thing of anointing Jesus' feet. Clearly, one serves through actions while the other simply wants to be with Jesus. The arguments that must have risen over the years can only be imagined. But this time, Mary doesn't just sit at Jesus' feet. This time she does something way more dramatic, even outrageous. All of the attention that is on Mary, she takes a pound of this expensive perfume. Mary anoints Jesus' feet and wipes his feet with her hair. To do that, Mary had to take her hair down and out from under the covering that she would have worn. And that wasn't culturally appropriate or done. Culture said that her hair should be covered at all times in public. There's no mention here in the scripture of, from Mary's point of view, about why Mary did this. We don't have a little parenthesis. Mary was thinking, and this is why she did what she did. Nor do we have something that says what her original intentions were. I was planning to do this, but I didn't. I did this instead. We don't get that kind of insight. But the meaning was clear. It's an ultimate pledge of loyalty to Jesus. An ultimate declaration and pledge that she loves Jesus with her whole heart and life. Since guests reclined at a meal, she could easily reach his feet as they laid on a couch with their feet behind them, not as we did, so it's not like she was crawling around under the table trying to get to Jesus' feet, that he would have been reclining on a couch, leaning on one arm, and eating from the table in front of him with his feet stretched out behind him. So it would have been easy to reach his feet. But it was a brazen act that left considerable tension in the room as strong, I think, as the perfume smell that filled the room with its beauty or odor, whichever way you might look at perfume. I'm guessing that Martha was embarrassed by her sister, or embarrassed for her sister maybe, and angry that she would do this. But it isn't Martha that's recorded as objecting to what Mary did. Nor is anything said about the inappropriate way in which Mary used her hair. The concern is all about the money. In Matthew and Mark, we learn that the disciples all share the concern that was stated by Judas. But John records Judas as the one who speaks up and says, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor?" Now, John is writing this book many years after the fact. And he comments on the fact that Judas will betray Jesus. And that he will gain 30 pieces of silver for disclosing the identity of Jesus and his presence. And that he really loves money to the point that he frequently took money from the common purse. As the treasurer, he had direct access to the funds and frequently siphoned off a bit for himself. So John clearly finds Judas is the one to blame for this erroneous assessment. But I'm guessing that at the time, it was a common feeling that Mary was being wasteful. 300 denarii actually is a lot of money, up to a year's wages for a laborer. But Jesus responds in a surprising manner when he says, "Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you don't always have me." Jesus isn't worried at all about the money. And Jesus suggests that Mary purchased the perfume so that she could anoint his body after he died. It's possible that Mary brought this expensive perfume intending just to take a dab and anoint Jesus with it, and ends up being way more extravagant than she intended. We don't know, again, that part of the story. Maybe it spilled. We don't know. But I think Mary is saying way more with her actions than she knows with her head. Way more, she is simply doing something that communicates way more than she can put into words. It's a prophetic act of devotion, one that's unplanned and just happens. It's like a compulsive act of devotion and a expression of her undying love for Jesus, one that she does. And yet it's true that Jesus will die soon. He will be killed on a cross and buried quickly. The timing will be such that there's not time to do the traditional burial and anoint the body with spices prior to his being placed in the tomb. So without knowing it consciously, really, Mary's actions are prophetic. I think sometimes the same thing is true for us. The message that it is given to us is prophetic and is beyond our knowing. It's not necessarily one we can figure out, or we know all of the implications, or we've even thought it through carefully enough to know if I do this or say this or think and act in this way, it will mean or be interpreted this way. It simply rises and we act or speak out of that prophetic knowing that comes from deep within. We are following the leadings as they come, living into trust and being faithful to the next piece as it rises, whether we understand it or not, whether we get all of the implications or not. It's choosing to be faithful. But what about Jesus' statement about the poor? You always have the poor with you. I think that statement has been used to justify the presence of poverty and the reality that we just have to accept it. You're always going to have the poor, so just live with it. The poor will be here, and there really isn't anything you can do about it. But Jesus refers to an Old Testament passage in Deuteronomy 15 when he talks about this. That passage, Deuteronomy 15, is filled with talk about Jubilee and the Hebrew concept that God gave to them of Jubilee and of setting the captives free, of returning the land back to the original owners, of a year of freedom and this writing of the upside down balance that happens in our world so that the poor need not live impoverished, but it can be righted in a powerful way. He says, if you obey me and do Jubilee, there will be no poor among you. But if you harden your hearts and are greedy, there will always be poverty. So this chapter is all about meeting the needs of others, including foreigners, not just their own people. It's in verse 11, he says, since there will never cease to be some in need on the earth, I therefore command you, open your hand to the poor and needy neighbor in your land. As we read through the Gospels, Jesus talks a lot about money and a lot about the greedy way in which the rich benefit from the poor and that they should not do that. He talks about the destructiveness of greed and the worship of mammon or the worship of money and how that is destructive and that we can't serve two masters, God and mammon, or God and the love of money that drives us to get ahead at the pursuit of overcoming others and of putting others down. So Jesus isn't saying the fact that you'll always have the poor with you, that he's telling us to simply accept and justify the acceptance of poverty while perpetuating systems that keep people poor. Rather, he's simply naming the reality that is present in a secular society, in our world, that has chosen not to live with this commitment to rebalancing, to living in such a way that all people have opportunity, this way of forgiveness and releasing people from debts. Finally, Jesus once again tells them that he will be with them no longer. He says, "You do not always have me." Within just a couple of weeks, Jesus will be crucified, but they still do not understand. But I want to go back to the present moment. The meal in the house at Bethany. Martha's in the kitchen. Jesus and his disciples and Lazarus are eating together. And Mary anoints Jesus with perfume, which fills the air and dries his feet with her hair. Judas objects, and Jesus says to leave her alone. Mary's actions erupt as both a prophetic act and a shameless act of undying love and devotion to Jesus. Are we willing to follow our leadings? Sometimes I think it will look outlandish and risky. Sometimes it will look like being too cautious and careful. That's why discernment is so important, that we discern our leadings, that we listen carefully about what God is calling us to do. It's a wild abandonment to trust and following our leadings in any given moment. A willingness to take risks and be present to that which rises within us, to trusting the leadings that come. We're so good at taking them down, stuffing them. No, that isn't what I should do. And learning to trust that God is faithful, that God will lead, and that we can trust the outcomes, that we can trust the ways in which it unfolds as much as Mary did, and that Jesus will say, "Let her alone, let him alone, follow me, follow my leadings," as God's extravagant love is expressed and showered over us. Let us listen as we wait in open worship and listen to God who speaks directly to us, that God of love that pursues us, that calls us to follow and encourages us to be willing to take risk and do that which rises within.